The question is that this House do now adjourn. Mr. Andrew Bridgen.
Thank you, Madam Deputy Speaker. 3 months ago, one of the UK's most eminent and trusted cardiologists, a man with an international reputation, Dr. Asim Malhotra, published peer-reviewed research that concluded that there should be a complete cessation in the administration of the COVID mRNA vaccines for everyone because of clear and robust data of significant harms and little ongoing benefit. He described the rollout of the biotech Pfizer vaccine as perhaps the greatest miscarriage of medical science, damage to population health, erosion of trust in public health, and attack on democracy that we will witness in our lifetime. Interesting, Madam Deputy Speaker, there's not been a single rebuttal so far in the scientific literature to Dr. Malhotra's findings, despite its widespread circulation and it making international news. Before I state the key evidence-based facts that make a clear case for complete suspension of these emergency use authorisation vaccines, it's important to appreciate the key psychological barrier as to why these facts have not been acknowledged by policymakers and taken up by the UK mainstream media. That psychological phenomenon is willful blindness. This is when human beings, including in this case institutions, turn a blind eye to the truth in order to feel safe, reduce anxiety, avoid conflict, and protect their prestige and reputations. There are numerous examples of this occurring in recent history, such as at the BBC with Jimmy Savile, the Department of Health and mid-staffs, Hollywood and Harvey Weinstein, and specifically in the medical establishment, the OxyContin scandal, which was portrayed in the mini-series Dope Stick. What's crucial to understand is that the longer willful blindness to the truth continues, the more unnecessary harm it creates. So here are the cold, hard facts on the mRNA vaccines and an explanation of the structural drivers that continue to be barriers to doctors and the public receiving independent information to make informed decisions about these vaccines. Since the rollout in the UK of the BioNTech Pfizer mRNA vaccine, we've had almost 500,000 yellow card reports of adverse effects from the public. Madam Deputy Speaker, this is unprecedented and is more than all the yellow card combined reports of the last 40 years. Such an extraordinary rate of side effects, which are beyond mild, have been reported in many countries across the world that have used the Pfizer vaccine, including, of course, the United States. Of course, I'll give way to the Honourable Gentleman.
I thank him for giving way. I spoke to the Honourable Gentleman beforehand. He knows my feelings about the vaccines. I'm a supporter of the vaccines. Many of my family are as well. But I understand where the Honourable Gentleman's come from. I've had some constituents who have come to me. And does the Honourable Gentleman agree we need to ensure in this House we acknowledge risks and don't simply relegate them to fine print?
He's absolutely right that those who feel they've been damaged by the vaccine should, of course, have the full support of their elected members of Parliament and, of course, the full support of the NHS. It's interesting that only a couple of weeks ago I was interviewed by a journalist from a major news outlet who said that he was being bombarded by calls from people who said that they were vaccine harmed but unable to get the support they wanted from the NHS. And he also said that he thought this would be the biggest scandal in the medical history in this country. And disturbingly, he also said that if he were to mention that in the newsroom in which he worked, he would fear that he would lose his job. And it is this conspiracy of silence that we need to break. Madam Deputy Speaker, it's instructive to note that traditionally, according to pharmacovigilance analysis, when it comes to serious adverse effects, what is actually reported by the public is thought to be only represent 10% of the true rate of serious adverse events occurring within the population. The gold standard of understanding the benefit and harm of any drug comes from the randomised controlled trial. It's the randomised controlled trial conducted by Pfizer that led to the UK and international regulators approving the BioNTech Pfizer mRNA vaccine in the first place for administration. Contrary to popular belief, that original trial of approximately 40,000 participants did not show any statistically significant reduction in death as a result of vaccination, but it did show a 95% relative risk reduction in the development of infection against the ancestral, more lethal strain of the virus. However, the absolute risk reduction for an individual was only 0.84%. In other words, from their own data, Pfizer revealed that you needed to vaccinate 119 people to prevent one infection. The World Health Organization and the Academy of Medical Royal Colleges have previously stated and made it clear that it's an ethical responsibility that medical information is communicated to patients in absolute benefit and absolute risk terms. This is to protect the public from unnecessary anxiety and manipulation. Very quickly, through mutations of that original strain, indeed within a few months, fortunately, it became far less lethal. And it quickly became apparent that there was no protection against infection from the vaccine at all. And we were left with the hope that perhaps these vaccines would protect us from serious illness and death. So what does the most reliable data tell us about the best case scenario of individual benefit from the vaccine against dying from COVID-19? Real world data from the UK during the 3-month wave of Omicron at the beginning of this year reveals that you'd need to vaccinate 7,300 people over the age of 80 to prevent one death. The number needed to be vaccinated to prevent a death in any younger age group was absolutely enormous.
Will you give way?
I will, of course, give way to my honourable friend.
I'm very grateful to him for giving way and for bringing this debate to the House. It's a very important debate that we should be having. He's just talking there about the relative risks for different cohorts of the population. He will remember that when the vaccine was first announced, the intention was that it would only be used for those who had who were vulnerable and the elderly, because, as he says, the expectation was that the benefit to younger people was minor. Do you think it would be helpful? Does he agree with me that it would be helpful for the minister to explain to us why the original advice that the vaccines would only be rolled out for the older population and would not be used for children in particular? Why that original advice was put laid aside and we ended up with a rollout for the entire population, including children?
Thank my honourable friend, the member for Devizes, for that intervention and his support on this very important issue. Of course, it's important that the government justify why they're rolling out a vaccine to any cohort of people, in particular our children. He will recall in the Westminster Hall debate that we questioned the validity of vaccinating children who have minimal risk, if at all, from the virus, but there's a clear risk from the vaccine. And I will again report on evidence from America later in my speech regarding those risks to particularly young children. So, in other words, the benefits of the vaccine are close to non-existent. Beyond the alarming yellow card reports, the strongest evidence of harm comes from the gold standard, highest possible quality level data, a reanalysis of the Pfizer-Moderna's own randomised controlled trials using the mRNA technology, published in the peer-reviewed journal Vaccine, revealed a rate of serious adverse events of 1 in 800 individuals vaccinated. These are events that result in hospitalisation, disability or a life-changing. What is most disturbing of all, however, is that of those original trials, suggesting that someone was far more likely to suffer a serious side effect from the vaccine than to be hospitalised with the ancestral, more lethal strain of the virus. These findings, Madam Deputy Speaker, are a smoking gun, suggesting that the vaccine should likely never have been approved in the first place. In the past, vaccines have been completely withdrawn from use for a much lower incidence of serious harm. For example, the swine flu vaccine was withdrawn in 1976 for causing Guillain-Barré syndrome in only 1 in 100,000 adults. And in 1999, the rotavirus vaccine was withdrawn for causing a form of bowel obstruction in children affecting 1 in 10,000. With the COVID mRNA vaccine, we're talking of a serious adverse event rate of at least 1 in 800, because that's the rate determined in the 2 months that Pfizer actually followed the patients following their vaccination. Unfortunately, some of those serious events affecting such as heart attack, stroke or pulmonary embolism will result in death, which is devastating for individuals and the families they leave behind. And many of these may take longer than 8 weeks post-vaccination to show themselves. An Israeli paper published in Nature Scientific Reports showed a 25% increase in heart attack and cardiac arrest in 16 to 39-year-olds in Israel. And another report from Israel, which is looking at the level of myocarditis and pericarditis in people who've had COVID and those who hadn't. It was a study, I think, of 1.2 million who hadn't had COVID and 740,000 who had COVID. The incidence of myocarditis and pericarditis was identical in both groups. This would tell the House that whatever is causing the increase in heart problems now, it's not due to having been infected with the COVID-19 vaccine. It was accepted by a peer-reviewed medical journal that one of the nation's most respected and decorated general practitioners, honorary vice president of the BMA, and the Labour Party's Doctor of the Year, Dr. Kailash Chand, likely suffered a cardiac arrest and was tragically killed by the Pfizer vaccine 6 months after his second dose through a mechanism that rapidly accelerates heart disease. In fact, in the UK, Madam Deputy Speaker, we've had an extra 14,000 out-of-hospital cardiac arrests in 2021 compared to 2020 following the vaccine rollout. Many of these will undoubtedly be because of the vaccine, and the consequences of this MRA jab are clearly serious and common. The ministers.
I'm very grateful, and I think he's making a very interesting and important speech. And in particular, he's giving a lot of detail about the Pfizer vaccine. Does he have similar concerns about other vaccines? And if so, will he be talking about those later in his speech?
I thank my honourable friend for that interjection. Clearly, this is relating to all mRNA vaccinations. He will be well aware that many of us will have had the AstraZeneca vaccine. That has effectively been withdrawn because of health concerns around. Indeed, I'll declare to the House I'm double vaccinated with AstraZeneca, which has now been withdrawn. The ministers may understandably wish to defer responsibility for a decision such as withdrawing the vaccines from the population to the regulators, such as the MHRA, or in America it would be the FDA. Historically, when undertaking the approval of any drug, the regulators themselves ultimately end up relying on the summary results of the drug companies in their sponsored trials, where the raw data is kept commercially confidential. Furthermore, the MHRA has a huge financial conflict of interest, receiving 86% of its funding from the pharmaceutical industry they are supposed to regulate. In effect, Madam Deputy Speaker, we've got the poacher paying the gamekeeper. As pointed out in a recent BMJ investigation into the financial conflicts of interest of the drug regulators, sociologist Donald Light said of them, "It's the opposite of having a trustworthy organisation independently and rigorously assessing medicines. They're not rigorous, they're not independent, they're selective, and they withhold data. Doctors and patients must appreciate how deeply and extensively drug regulators can't be trusted so long as they're captured by the industry funding." Similarly, another investigation revealed that members of the JCVI have huge financial links to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, running to billions of pounds. The ministers, the media and the public know that the foundation itself is heavily invested in the pharmaceutical industry stocks. Unfortunately, the catastrophic mistake over the approval and the coercion associated with this emergency use authorisation medical intervention is not an anomaly, but in many ways it could have been predicted by structural failures that have allowed this to occur in the first place. These shortcomings are rooted in the increasingly unchecked, visible and invisible power of multinational corporations, in this case Big Pharma. We start by acknowledging that the drug industry has a fiduciary obligation to produce profit for their shareholders. Madam Deputy Speaker, they have no fiduciary obligation to provide the right medicines for patients. The real scandal is that those with a responsibility to patients and scientific integrity, namely doctors, academic institutions and medical journals, collude with the industry for financial gain. Big Pharma exerts its power by capturing the political environment through lobbying, the knowledge environment through funding university research and influencing medical education, preference shaping through capture of the media, financing, think tanks, etc., etc. In other words, the PR machinery of pharma excels in subterfuge, engages in smearing and deplatforming those who call out their manipulations. No doubt, Madam Deputy Speaker, they will be very busy this evening. It's no surprise that because of so much control by an entity that has been described as psychopathic for its profit-making conduct, that one analysis suggests that the third most common cause of death globally, after heart disease and cancer, is because of the side effects of prescribed medications, which were mostly avoidable. Because of these systemic failures, doctors often receive biased information, deliberately manipulated by the pharmaceutical industry, that exaggerates the benefits and minimises and also exaggerates the safety of their drugs. Furthermore, the former editor of the BMJ, Richard Smith, claims that research misconduct is rife and is not effectively being tackled in the UK institutions, he states, something is rotten in British medicine, and it has been for a long time. Madam Deputy Speaker, it's also been brought to my attention by a whistleblower from a very reliable source that one of these institutions is covering up clear data that reveals the mRNA vaccine increases inflammation of the heart arteries. They are covering this up in fear that they may lose funding from the pharmaceutical industry. The lead of that cardiology research department has a prominent leadership role with the British Heart Foundation, and I'm very disappointed to say that he has sent out non-disclosure agreements to his research team to ensure that this important data never sees the light of day. This, Madam Deputy Speaker, is an absolute disgrace. Such systemic failure in an over-medicated population also contributes to huge waste of British taxpayers' money and increasing strain on the NHS.
Will you give way?
I will give way on that point.
You've been very good with this time. I just wanted to call his attention to the research that I chair the All-Party Parliamentary Group on prescribed drug dependency, and he refers to the waste of money. There's £500 million being spent every year by the NHS on prescribed drugs for people who shouldn't be on those habit-forming pills. Enormous human misery as well as waste for the taxpayer.
My honourable friend for making a point which only reinforces the items in my speech which the public need to know, and I thank him again for his support. We clearly need an inquiry into the influence of Big Pharma on medications and our NHS, and this has been called for on many occasions, indeed by some very, very influential people, including prominent physicians, such as the former president of the Royal College of Physicians and personal doctor to our former Queen, Sir Richard Thompson. On a separate occasions in the last few years, these calls have been supported also and covered in the Daily Mail, The Guardian, and most recently the I newspaper. We're not just fighting for principles of ethical, evidence-based medical practice here, but we're also fighting for our democracy. The future health of the British public depends on us tackling head-on the cause of this problem and finding meaningful solutions. In 2015, a commentary by Richard Horton, editor-in-chief of The Lancet, suggested that possibly half of the published medical literature may simply be untrue. He wrote that science has taken a turn towards darkness and asked who is going to take the first step to clean up the system. Well, Madam Deputy Speaker, that first step could start this evening with this debate. It starts here, and the Vaccine Minister and the Government ensuring in the first instance that there needs to be an immediate and complete suspension of any more COVID vaccines than their use of mRNA technology. Madam Deputy Speaker, silence on this issue is more contagious than the virus itself. And I'd also, now so should courage be. And I would implore all the scientists, the medics, the nurses, and those in the media who know the truth about the harm these vaccines are causing to our people to speak out. Madam Deputy Speaker, we've already sacrificed, in my view, far too many of our citizens on the altar of ignorance and unfettered corporate greed. Last week, the MHRA authorised these experimental vaccines for use on children as young as 6 months. A report, which I've already quoted in a Westminster Hall debate some weeks ago, by the Journal of American Medical Associations, studying the effects of the COVID-19 mRNA vaccination on children under 5 years of age, showed that 1 in 200 had an adverse event, which resulted in hospitalisation and had symptoms that lasted longer than 90 days. As the data clearly shows, to anyone who wants to look at it, the mRNA vaccines, they're not safe, they're not effective, and they're not necessary. I implore the government to halt their use immediately, and as I've demonstrated, and the data clearly shows, the government's current policy on the mRNA vaccines is on the wrong side of medical ethics. It's on the wrong side of scientific data. And ultimately, Madam Deputy Speaker, it will be on the wrong side of history. Mr. Deputy Speaker, on the 13th of December last year, I was kindly granted an adjournment debate on the potential harms that emergency use experimental mRNA COVID-19 vaccines cause. It's fair to say that night my life changed. During that speech, in the evidence data I presented to the House, which no one has effectively rebutted, I highlighted to the Minister the scale of harms that the experimental vaccines have caused and continue to cause. In giving that speech to an almost empty chamber on this most important of issues, quite literally life and death, two things happened to me immediately. First, I was cancelled by the mainstream media, despite sending a data sheet in the wake of the debate, scientifically evidencing every point that I made. Not one media organisation wanted to talk about the issue of serious harms or death occurring as a result of the mRNA vaccines. Mr. Deputy Speaker, I fully expect that they will show the same level of disinterest in today's debate. It's what we've come to expect from a media more interested in navel-gazing at the pontifications of Britain's foremost football pundit instead of the horror and tragedy of excess deaths taking place before their very eyes. Some 3 months on from that speech, and a scattering of reports are now appearing in the mainstream media, sadly, the number of people affected in the UK and across the world cannot be ignored or hidden indefinitely.
Well, Mal, thank you.
I will on that point.
Will you accept that there's a bit of a light on the horizon in that this week alone, the Daily Express has had 4 full pages on this subject?
I thank my right honourable friend. He's a stalwart supporter for those who've been vaccine harmed, and I do hope that we can see some light at the end of the tunnel, and hopefully this speech today will bring more light into the darkness. In truth, I care little about being cancelled by the media, because in the wake of that speech, something far more important has happened. I was contacted by thousands of people offering their support and received many hundreds and hundreds of emails from all over the globe recounting to me their own stories of the harms caused in the wake of their or their loved ones' COVID vaccination. I've been contacted by parents in my own and surrounding constituencies thanking me for questioning why we're giving these experimental vaccinations to healthy children and young people that patently do not need them and gain no protection from them. I was contacted by far too many relatives who had lost loved ones suddenly after having the Moderna, Pfizer or AstraZeneca experimental gene therapy treatments shot into their arms. Many of them asked in their emails why this vitally important issue was not being taken more seriously by many of my honourable and right honourable colleagues. That, Mr. Deputy Speaker, is a question for my colleagues to answer. A lot more questioned why, as evidence continues to emerge almost on a daily basis, the Fourth Estate was so remiss in its coverage. That, Mr. Deputy Speaker, is a question for the lobby to answer. But every one of those who contacted me asked me to keep up the fight, to continue to raise awareness of vaccine harms and vaccine deaths. Mr. Deputy Speaker, that is the question I am here to answer today. Despite the media silence, there is huge, enormous and growing interest in this topic. So today I once again ask the Minister why more is not being done, both in the United Kingdom and globally, to investigate and publicise the clear and well-documented adverse effects of COVID-19 vaccines. Vaccines, Mr Deputy Speaker, that have made Big Pharma billions, but also vaccines that have resulted in completely unprecedented levels of yellow card reports. Mr Deputy Speaker, the government's own data in this respect is damning. It is interesting that only this week the MHRA, the Medicines and Healthcare Product Regulatory Agency, have announced that they will no longer be publicly reporting the yellow card updates from the reported harms of these experimental treatments. Can the Minister explain the reasoning behind this decision, especially given that the number of yellow card reports of adverse events are far higher for the experimental COVID-19 vaccine than the total yellow card reports of all conventional vaccines administered for the last 50 years. Mr Deputy Speaker, if you'll grant me a little leeway, let me start by looking at data from the US state of Florida and the reported level of vaccine harms there. Prior to the COVID pandemic, there were never more than 2,500 incidents per year of harms reported to the state Surgeon General as a direct result of vaccination. In 2021, that number shot up to over 41,000 cases, a surge of more than 1,600%. Of course, some will understandably point out that the increase in cases was inevitable as more vaccines were being administered. The answer to that, Mr Deputy Speaker, in the state of Florida, there was a 400% increase in vaccine administration in 2021, not 1,600%. Mr Deputy Speaker, in the state of Florida and in the rest of the world, 1,600 doesn't go into 400. It never has and it never will. The real-world data from Florida shows the mRNA vaccines are resulting in vaccine harms disproportionate to the number of vaccines being administered when compared to all previous vaccinations. And this backs up the clear warning signal from our own yellow card system in the UK. Data held on the US Government National Library of Medicine was used for research by Dr. Joseph Fryman, which details the frequency of serious adverse events following vaccination with both Pfizer and Moderna mRNA vaccines. For clarity, Mr. Deputy Speaker, a serious adverse event is defined as anything that results in death, is life-threatening at the time of the event, results in inpatient hospitalisation, or prolongation of existing hospitalisation, persistent or significant disability or incapacity, a congenital anomaly or birth defect, or something considered as medically important based on medical judgment. Using that definition, the study confirms that there are 10.1 serious adverse events for every 10,000 Pfizer vaccinations administered. Mr Deputy Speaker, that means that one in every 990 people vaccinated with the Pfizer booster will have a serious adverse event. The risk with the Moderna vaccine is even greater. There are 15.1 serious adverse events for every 10,000 Moderna jabs. That means one in 662 people vaccinated with the Moderna booster will have a serious adverse event. Combining the data for Pfizer and Moderna mRNA vaccines or boosters, we can see that there are an average of 1,250 serious adverse events for every 1 million vaccine boosters administered. In other words, an average of 1 in 800 chance of a serious adverse event every time someone is boosted. So let's move on now to the UK government data. On the 25th of January of this year, the Department of Health and Social Care published data from a presentation given by the UK Health Security Agency to the JCVI, the Joint Committee on Vaccination and Immunisation. The data published split the population into groups by age and further divided those age groups into those considered healthy and at risk. The numbers needed to vaccinate, or the NNV, for each of these subgroups were calculated to firstly prevent a single hospitalisation and secondly a single serious hospitalisation requiring oxygen or intubation, effectively intensive care. The figures are stark, Mr Deputy Speaker. What I'm quoting from is the government's own published data. To prevent just one healthy adult aged between 50 and 59 from being hospitalised due to COVID, the government's own data states that 43,600 people had to be given an autumn booster jab. With a serious adverse event rate of 1 in 800, that means that in the healthy 50 to 59-year-old group, as a result of using the mRNA boosters, 55 people would die or be put into hospital with side effects to prevent one single case presenting of COVID presenting in hospital. The same data shows that for the healthy younger people, the number needed to be boosted to prevent a single hospital admission with COVID-19 is far higher. 92,500 booster jabs were required to be administered to prevent one hospitalisation due to COVID in the healthy 40 to 49-year-old group, which would simultaneously have put 116 people at probability of death or serious adverse reaction into hospital from the jab. The healthy 30 to 39-year-old age group required 210,400 booster jabs to prevent a single COVID hospitalisation. So 263 of this group will have been into hospital or sadly died as a result of the booster side effects just to keep one COVID case out of hospital. But the data gets worse because hospitalisation doesn't necessarily mean a serious medical intervention such as intubation or oxygen. To prevent severe hospitalisation from COVID-19, the numbers needed to be boosted become astronomical. I would suggest that this is the real benchmark for comparison with the risks of death or serious adverse events from the boosters themselves. So the government's own data shows that in healthy adults aged 50 to 59, it was necessary to give 256,400 booster jabs to prevent just one severe hospitalisation, putting 321 people into hospital with a serious side effect from the booster, which includes, obviously, risk of death. For 40 to 49-year-olds, that number increases to 932,500 who need to be boosted to keep one COVID patient out of ITU, putting potentially 1,165 people into hospital with serious harms, death or disability. And for the healthy 30 to 39-year-olds, no one knows the answer to the number needed to be boosted to prevent a serious hospitalisation, because the government's own data says that there's never been such a case of this age group being put into intensive care due to the current variant of COVID-19. But many, indeed on average, 1 in 800 of them, of this group that's been boosted, will have died or been disabled or seriously harmed by the booster itself. Let me focus now on the most vulnerable group for which the government data is available. The over 70s, with comorbidities, the most vulnerable group in our society. According to the government's own data, it would be necessary to administer 800 vaccine boosters to prevent just one hospitalisation for a patient over the age of 70 in this highest risk group. Mr Deputy Speaker, that means that all the most vulnerable group in our society are doing, by being boosted, is swapping one risk from COVID of hospitalisation for exactly the same risk from the booster itself. But of course, in the process, Big Pharma is making huge profits. Mr Deputy Speaker, we've looked at the health implications of the vaccine programme. Now I want to look at some of the costs implications of the booster programme in the UK. Total funding of COVID-19 vaccination programme in the UK up to the end of March this year is budgeted at £8.3 billion. In February 2022, the GP online website, Championing General Practice Professionals, published that GPs and community pharmacies were being paid £24 per dose for administering vaccines. That figure increased to £34 per dose at dedicated vaccine centres. These costs, of course, do not include the cost of the experimental vaccines themselves. For ease of calculation, I will count those at £20 per dose across the board. I will be generous and use the lower of the two figures for administering the vaccine, giving a total cost of £44 per dose. But even then, we see from the government's own data, using boosters, it costs over £1.9 million to prevent just one hospitalisation among healthy 50 to 59-year-olds, and over £11 million to prevent one serious hospitalisation due to COVID-19 in this age group. The cost to the taxpayer of preventing a hospitalisation of one healthy 40 to 49-year-old is over £4 million using boosters,
And for healthy 30 to 39-year-olds, the cost of preventing just one hospitalisation is over £9 million, Mr Deputy Speaker. Of course, to prevent serious hospitalisation in all these groups, the cost is far, far higher. It is, of course, worth noting that in setting up the vaccine programme, the government indemnified vaccine manufacturers, which gave them total cover against all future claims of the adverse effects of their products. Given what I've already explained about the incidence of serious side effects, that cost may well be extremely significant to the taxpayer on top of the obvious human tragedy and loss which is self-evidently happening. The data is clear. For all healthy people and all those considered at risk under 70, the probability of being seriously harmed by COVID are seriously outweighed by the risk associated from the experimental vaccines and boosters. Even for the most vulnerable group, the over 70s, with health problems, the risks are absolutely identical. The government data comments not only on the efficacy and effectiveness of the autumn booster campaign, which I've quoted from, we've already had that, but it also looks forward to this year's booster campaign. Not unsurprisingly, it predicts the same level of efficacy from the same boosters put into the same arms. Surely, in light of the data, that we're not going to continue with this absolute madness. Mr Deputy Speaker, if we were to perpetuate this, what we'll actually be doing is engaging in very expensive state-sponsored self-harm on a national level. Mr Deputy Speaker, in the winter of 2020, the experimental mRNA vaccines were announced to the British public as being safe and effective. That narrative was repeated by the Vaccine Minister in her response to my speech in this place on the 13th of December. It is interesting that today the NHS website describes the experimental vaccines as safe and important, and it describes serious side effects as being very rare. But the truth, as we know, is somewhat different. One in 800 is not rare, especially when the public is expected to take multiple doses, exposing themselves again and again to the same risk. Mr Deputy Speaker, the government needs to be honest about this, just like they need to be honest about the fact that the MHRA is funded 86% by Big Pharma. The experimental mRNA vaccines from the manufacturer's own trial data are not safe, with an average of 1 in 800 people taking them facing death or serious injury as a result. Despite the initial and repeated assurances, the experimental mRNA vaccines from the government's own data, they're not effective at preventing infection, transmission or hospitalisation from COVID-19. The experimental mRNA vaccines are not necessary given the risk-benefit of the treatment, and the experimental mRNA vaccines are costing the country a fortune and creating huge pressure on the NHS from the side effects. I would therefore ask the Minister, given that the data released on the 25th of January by the UK Health Security Agency was actually presented to the JCVI on the 25th of October 2022, why was the booster rollout not halted last October, given the clear lack of efficacy and the evidence of risks being greater than the benefit to all age groups, except possibly the over 70s, with underlying health conditions where the risk was absolutely identical? Was the data presented to the JCVI passed to the MHRA? If so, when? And if not, why not? Why were the MHRA still asking the government to authorise the experimental vaccines to be administered to children down to the age of 6 months of age in December 2022, 6 weeks after the booster efficacy data was received by the JCVI? If the data was not passed to the MHRA, the Medicines and Healthcare Product Regulatory Agency, surely the JCVI should have spoken out against the vaccination of small children last December. I'm sure, Mr Deputy Speaker, that despite the members of the JCVI having declared an interest of over £1 billion between them of investments in Big Pharma, this would never have influenced their judgment. Can the Minister also confirm the fact that two-thirds of NHS staff refused last autumn's booster? The simple facts are that in light of the government's own data, COVID vaccinations and boosters are not effective, and from the evidence of the yellow card system, they're not safe, and to the UK taxpayer, they are not value for money. Indeed, given the side effects, Mr Deputy Speaker, if they were free, we couldn't afford them. The only ones who really benefit from the booster rollout are Big Pharma, with their licence to print money and indemnification against the harms of their products cause. Once again, Mr. Deputy Speaker, Big Pharma have put profits before people, and on this occasion, governments across the globe have been their willing marketing agents. The whole COVID-19 narrative is slowly unravelling. As I believe I've demonstrated today, Mr. Deputy Speaker, no one should have been boosted after the efficacy data was received on the 25th of October last year, and no one should be boosted in future based on that data. Given the evidence of harms by the boosters, I now believe that we have the full explanation of both the continuing excess deaths we've seen since the pandemic, 63,000 excess deaths in England and Wales in the last 12 months, and also the reason for the huge and unrelenting pressure of demand on the NHS. Mr. Deputy Speaker, it's the vaccines and the boosters and their side effects. Sadly, I am confident that I'll be proved correct. I sincerely wish it was not so. But the longer it takes our government to accept the truth, the more people will be harmed and die. The first step to putting right a problem is always to admit there is a problem. The government narrative of safe and effective is in tatters, as evidenced by their own data. 3 months on from my original speech in this House, we have surely now sacrificed enough of our citizens on the lives on the altar of ignorance and unfettered corporate greed to satisfy anyone. I therefore call on the government to immediately stop the mRNA vaccine booster programme and initiate a full public inquiry into not only the vaccine harms, but how every agency and institution set up to protect the public interest have failed so abysmally in their duties. I look forward to the Minister's response. I'm aware that it's neither his area of responsibility or expertise, and I will accept that any questions he can't answer at the dispatch box today, that he will send to me in writing.
Minister Wilkins.
Well, thank you, Mr. Deputy Speaker. And as the Honourable Gentleman says, I'm responding to the debate on behalf of the Honourable Member for Lewis. Vaccines have underpinned the government's strategy for living with COVID-19. They have saved tens of thousands of lives, reduced the pressure on our NHS, and were instrumental in allowing our economy and society to reopen. COVID-19 has not gone away, and thousands of people in the United Kingdom continue to be infected each week. Vaccines remain our best line of defence and the most effective way to enable us to live with the virus. Countless studies have shown that vaccinated people are less likely to die or become seriously ill from the virus. And thanks to the huge efforts of NHS staff and, of course, the public, as of the 5th of March, over 144 million vaccine doses have been provided in England alone. This includes over 17 million in the recent autumn booster campaign, which concluded last month. Now, the Honourable Gentleman specifically referred to the efficacy of the mRNA COVID-19 boosters. And it's important, Mr. Deputy Speaker, to put on record that all of the vaccines used in the UK COVID-19 vaccination programme have been through a rigorous approval process. The UK has some of the highest safety standards in the world, and the independent Medicines and Healthcare Products Regulatory Agency, the MHRA, is globally recognised for requiring high standards of quality, safety and effectiveness. And the mRNA COVID-19 boosters approved for use in the United Kingdom have also been through similar rigorous approval processes by the EMA in Europe and the FDA in the United States. And each potential COVID-19 vaccine is assessed by teams of scientists and clinicians on a case-by-case basis. There are extensive checks and balances required by law at every stage of vaccine development. And it is only once each potential vaccine has met robust standards of quality, safety and efficacy set by the MHRA that it will be approved for use. Now, both the mRNA and non-mRNA vaccines have already been administered as booster doses, with the majority of doses administered in the recent autumn booster being mRNA vaccines. And data shows that COVID-19 boosters have been highly effective in reducing hospitalisations and death, with the mortality rate consistently lower for people who have had at least a third dose or booster dose compared with individuals who are unvaccinated or received just a first or second dose. Earlier this month, Mr. Deputy Speaker, the Office for National Statistics published their latest COVID-19 effectiveness estimates. They showed between March 21 and March 22, a third booster dose was approximately 93% effective in reducing the risk of mortality from COVID-19, compared to 58% for a first dose and 88% for a second dose.
and 77% effective in reducing the risk of hospitalisation, compared to 52% for a first dose and 55% for the second dose. This highlights the effectiveness of all COVID-19 vaccinations and shows that protection only increases following a third dose or booster, as supported by other extensive research, such as the UK HSA surveillance reports. And the most recent data from UK HSA on the autumn 22 booster campaign showed that the mRNA bivalent boosters provided incremental protection against hospitalisations on top of the protection already provided by previous doses in the period following the 5th of September 22. It also showed that the effectiveness against hospitalisation remained high at 10 or more weeks after vaccination, which was vital in supporting the NHS over a particularly challenging winter period. Now, the Honourable Gentleman also raised the ongoing vaccine surveillance, and the surveillance of vaccines does not stop at the point of approval. The MHRA and the UK Health Security Agency continuously monitor a wide range of data regarding the safety and effectiveness of the vaccines, including reports, as the Honourable Gentleman pointed out, of adverse reactions from the UK and internationally. And as part of this surveillance, the MHRA's monitoring role includes reviewing all suspected adverse drug reaction reports, known as yellow card reports, relating to COVID-19 vaccines. And through that MHRA yellow card scheme, members of the public and healthcare professionals are able to report any suspected side effects. And the nature of yellow card reporting means that reported events are not always proven side effects. Some events may have happened anyway, regardless of vaccination. Now, this comprehensive surveillance strategy alerts us to any unforeseen adverse reactions to the vaccines and enables us to act swiftly when required. Now, Mr. Deputy Speaker, the government is also committed to further research into COVID vaccines. And since the start of the pandemic, the National Institute for Health Research, the NIHR, has allocated more than £110 million in funding for COVID-19 vaccine research. And that has included consideration of vaccine safety, including robust monitoring of adverse reactions to COVID-19 vaccines. So in summary, Mr. Deputy Speaker, we know that the COVID vaccination programme has saved tens of thousands of lives and has prevented many more from being hospitalised. The government has recently announced that a targeted seasonal vaccination offer will come in England on the 17th of April, which will top up the protection of those at the highest risk. Vaccination of residents in older adult care homes will start ahead of this from Monday, the 3rd of April. And the primary aim, Mr. Deputy Speaker, of the spring programme continues to be the prevention of severe disease, hospitalisations and, of course, death. And older persons, residents in care homes for older adults and those who are immunosuppressed continue to be at highest risk of severe COVID-19 and therefore prioritised for vaccination. Mr. Deputy Speaker, the COVID vaccine programme is something of which this country can be very proud, and I would like to reiterate my thanks to the scientists, clinical staff, volunteers and others who helped make this happen.
Questions of this House do now adjourn. As many of that opinion say aye. Aye. Contrary, no. The ayes have